Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Recovery Radio broadcast recorded live at the Leyte Recovery Center in downtown Moscow. At the LRC, we work with people to enter and engage in recovery from addiction and behavioral health disorders through peer-to-peer interaction and evidence-based practices to promote a healthy community. Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Leyte Recovery Center, which is located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at leyterecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at leyterecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community about addiction and behavioral health disorders and to make our community aware of the recovery resources available from the Leyte Recovery Center. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for those struggling with addiction and behavioral health disorders. And the February calendar, please go to our website at leyterecoverycenter.org to see what our offerings are for this week and the month going forward. And I am Radio Johnny. I am a grateful recovered alcoholic, recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And my co-host today is...
Hi, I'm Denise, and I'm a follower of Jesus and a grateful recovered addict.
Hey, Denise.
Hey, and Johnny.
We've got a couple of announcements here. And Denise, you want to talk about the fundraiser a little bit?
Very, very much so, would like to. So the fundraiser, the time is near for our 6th annual fundraising breakfast and dessert. This year's event is March 2nd at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. at the Best Western University Inn. This event has grown to be a virtual part of our budget, raising approximately $40,000 last year. Our event succeeds because we use table captains to recruit our attendees to the event. What does a table captain do? Well, glad you asked. They invite people to a free breakfast or dessert, making sure your people know we're hoping that they will make a donation. And that's it. Please contact Daryl Keim at Leyte Recovery Center at gmail.com if you can help.
All right. And I have a little announcement about the Artist in Residence program. If you're interested in the LRC's Artists in Residence program, you can find information on the program as well as application information on the LRC website at, again, leyterecoverycenter.org. And just click on the Artists in Residence tab at the top of the homepage. The deadline for the first residency has passed and will be starting the first residency in March. But you can still apply for the second and third residencies, which will be going on from June to August and September through November. And the deadlines are published on the website for that. The residencies, just so you know, they include a $500 stipend and a gallery show and reception at the end of the residencies. And artists of all fine art discipline are encouraged to apply, including musicians. And again, go to the LRC website for details and application instructions. And today in the studio, we have a guest, a woman I have known. We were just talking about it for almost 20 years in a very roundabout way. And her name is Jane. And Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Johnny.
We were talking a little bit before we went on air, and I'm going to ask you to share what we call an AA experience, strength, and hope, which is really your story of your life leading up to and including addiction, what happened to have you make a change, and what life like is in recovery for you now. So I'm just going to throw it out to you and let you kick it off.
I'm Jane, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic and an addict of more. As most of us know, our backstory doesn't begin when we pick up the first drink or the first drug. it goes back to the very first time when we needed something and didn't get it. Something, whether it was a parent's attention, whether it was something provided by a neighbor that wasn't exactly like grandpa, on to just craving attention in ways that we shouldn't be available to us because it's not healthy. As I got into my adulthood, I was craving more in that attention. And when I didn't get it, then I started to drink. Well, that was always never a good idea because I wasn't a maintenance drinker. As several members of my family who are maintenance drinkers, I thought I could drink like them. Well, actually, I was a binge drinker. Until it was ran out, I ran out of money, or the last guy left the bar that was buying me drinks. When I went to treatment, I've got about 11 and a half years now, and I went to treatment in Southern Idaho. We were in a class, and they were going around the room talking to people about how much money did you spend when you were out there drinking and drugging. And I heard thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars. She came to me. I said, I didn't spend a dime. The instructor was like, what? I said, I'm a reasonably good-looking woman, and I've got big tits. I can go to a bar. Why in the heck should I buy alcohol? Everybody busted a gut, of course, but that's my truth. I was a binge drinker. When I had the opportunity to go out, I did. That work is very, very hard on relationships that I thought were going to be different. And when they didn't turn out to be different from what I had before, then I went right back to it. My last day of drinking, I was at Hot August Nights down in the valley. And my friends didn't make it to meet me quite as early as they had hoped. And by the end of the evening, when they finally got there, I had drank all 6 tickets. So there's a 6-pack of beer. The end of the night, went to a local bar, 3 spider bites in, and I was as sober as a judge. I had no idea what drinking yourself sober was. I had heard it talked around, but nobody really explained to me that it's when, for me, it was when my brain knew that if the alcohol quit working, I was going to have to try something different. And that scared me. I have friends that have bridged that alcohol to drug association very easily and gone on to, quote unquote, bigger, better things, more like worse and more destructive. But for me, it scared me enough that I called someone whose son I grew up with. I knew he was in recovery. So was her daughter-in-law. She made arrangements for her daughter-in-law to meet me the next morning. I had 14 days of a project in the valley before I could leave town. She helped me white knuckle it through that 14 days before I could get on a plane and fly to Boise. And I'll always be grateful to these people for that. They certainly didn't know me well enough to feel obligated. I was by no means family, but they treated me like I was family. 28 days later, I'm back in the valley, and I just wasn't really sure what my life was going to be like. I knew my marriage was falling apart, partially my fault, partially his, but I just was angry because I had asked him to just go to an Al-Anon meeting with this gal that had held my hand. He didn't. And I told him I just gutted myself. You didn't do squat. I was furious. I walked out the door. I stayed in a hotel for 3 nights. And then by then I'd made arrangements to live someplace else. Fortunately, all this was after my daughter was grown and gone. But she saw me host many parties, music, and all different kinds of events over the years. Fortunately, she is not of an addictive behavior, so she matches like half my family. And then I'm on the other side of the fence. It's just been interesting since I came back. I rented a room for a while, went through the first month of sweating night sweats. Oh my gosh, they were horrible. The best part about them is I was told they'd end at some point. I was grateful that morning when I woke up and I didn't have to change and wash my sheets before I went to work because I had just absolutely soaked everything. Fortunately, I've kept the same job through this whole time. That I'm grateful for. I have gone to various meetings in various locations. In fact, when we go to the Oregon coast, I know a couple really awesome meetings in Newport. If anybody needs to know, I'll leave the information with Chani and Denise. Going on vacation, it's always good to have the opportunity for a tune-up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I try and make a point of that when I travel. You know, even before I go, get on that local area's district website. Yeah, it's a good deal.
That has saved my bacon more than once. Do you guys have any questions for me?
Oh, sure. Denise, you got something?
You go first. I'm okay. Thinking. I was just intently listening. There enjoying. You go.
I do have questions because, you know, so many parts of your story, you know, are a common theme with people like me. I was one of those maintenance drinkers, but I certainly can understand a binge because I wasn't always a maintenance drinker. You know, those younger years, it was always, you know, drink till you puke and then drink some more.
Is that so explain this maintenance drinker.
Well, maintenance drinker mm-hmm. would be somebody who, when they start drinking, you know, they may have a time of day, like, I'm not going to drink till after work, but from 5:30 when they either get home or go mm-hmm. to the bar, they will drink, and they'll drink to a certain level of intoxication and then kind of try and stay there, and they maintain that level. And then,
for the most part, they go to work the next day, right?
A lot of them do, okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, in my case, I went to work until they didn't want me at work anymore mm-hmm. because my maintenance drinking was 24 hours a day. I mean, literally waking up in the middle of the night, not really waking up, is coming to from being passed out, okay. And then, you know, drinking to get back to that have that level to get rid of the shakes or mm-hmm. to get back to yeah. that level of intoxication. So, okay. But yeah, that I don't think maintenance drinking is better or worse than binge drinking. Obviously, you know, you're an alcoholic if you decide you're an alcoholic and call yourself an alcoholic. But certainly we can look at people that when they take a drink, just one drink, and then they have no control over their drinking from that point. That is definitely alcoholic behavior. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's described in the big book that way. Mm-hmm. If you can't control what's going to happen after the first drink, maybe you're one of us. Right. I relate to a lot of parts of your story that, especially when you're talking about people close to you maybe not working with you. That is, it can be devastating. In my relationship, I own the problem 100%, and I let my wife know that there are avenues for her to pursue if she likes to. If she chooses not to, that's fine with me. As long as she understands that, you know, my behavior is changing and it may weird her out, and she doesn't want to deal with it, then it's just going to weird her out. And she has to deal with that. That's going to have to be her reality around me. I remember early on not wanting, you know, wanting her to, you know, really understand what I was going through. The reality hit me, though, at a point that she's a normal, healthy, you know, mm-hmm. she's one of those half a glass of wine people, you know, and leave it sitting there. I don't get it. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. I wanted her to embrace and just be so happy for me. And she's like, look, I've been putting up with a drunk for years, you know. Don't expect a gold medal for taking the friggin' garbage out. And that was my thing. I thought, oh, I am so cool now.
We're on a different, usually it's like we're on this excited page and it takes a while for everyone else to catch up.
Right.
If they do. They have to like see the change for a little while longer.
Yeah.
Because there's a little disbelief, at least in my story, where it's like, mom really changed, you know? Oh, I think she is. Well, I'm not sure. You know, like one was like, yeah, I think she is. And the other one was like, well, we'll see. So it just takes time.
Yeah. I'll wait and see. Yeah. Well, and you say, you know, I know a little bit of your background and I know you were involved in events you talked about that involved large groups of people and lots of partying. So that must have been tough, not only I'm sure it fueled your moreism, as I'll call it. Coin that phrase. Write that down.
Yeah, moreism.
How was that afterwards? Were you able to still move in those crowds with any sort of confidence, or was it weird?
It was very strange for the first 3 years. And fortunately, the night that I got sober, God removed the temptation. He moved the craving.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a craving for it anymore. And it was like being struck by lightning.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't really able to do some of the things, community things that I'd been very involved in. Just I chose to back off and just make changes. Well, about 3 years in, a friend called and wanted to help with an event. And it's always been that, you know, I'm not an artist. I don't paint. I don't draw. I write a little music, and give me a cell phone and I can have a party planned in an hour with food and music. That's my superpower. So I got a call. She's like, I need help putting this together. So I ended up putting her in touch with the people that before I would call myself. Or I would call them and say, this person wants to do this. Here's their contact information.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very rewarding to know that she was able to use those contacts, and a relief that I knew I didn't have to.
Oh, yeah. I can just imagine.
Making good decisions. That's cool.
Well, and you, Johnny, you'd mentioned about the more thing. There is a AA speaker that I've worn out 4 copies of the same CDs because I enjoy him so much. And he talks about the duck and the eagle. You know, you go into a bar, you're a weedy little duck, have a few drinks, and you come out an eagle.
Right.
You know, that's something that, for me, it fueled my self-confidence. I could be bigger, better, be more beautiful, anything, just by having a couple drinks. And it worked great for about 70% of the time until I started getting sloppy drunk, and then on to the nausea and the whole hung over till noon when I had to go to work the next day.
Right. I remember somebody, it had like a t-shirt and it had a picture of 2 shot glasses and it said, I'm funny. And then it had 4 shot glasses and it says, I'm good looking. Then it had 6 shot glasses and it says, I'm irresistible. And then there's 8 shot glasses and it says, I'm visible. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've been through those stages where it does boost your confidence. I mean, I think as a young person, I was hard to believe, was not real outgoing. And a couple of beers just really changed my personality. I became very outgoing, very gregarious.
It's guy with the crazy hat on dancing around somewhere, huh?
Right, right, yeah. Right. Hat, lampshade, whatever was handy. Yeah. But to be able to fall down and recognize that, my realization that I couldn't drink anymore like I had been drinking came to me like, you know, just small quiet voice in the middle of the night waking up, you know, and realizing there wasn't enough left in the pint bottle to get me through to when the liquor store opened the next day. And it was just a straight up realization, I can't drink like this anymore. Mm-hmm. And I out loud said, God, I need help. And finished off the bottle, passed back out, and went on from there. I didn't have the advantage of going to a treatment center. I probably should have gone to the hospital because I just went through withdrawals on my own. Not a fun party at all, but did manage once I started feeling, you know, stopped shaking, started feeling a little better, had some food and got some fluids back in my system. You know, I did manage to stumble into an AA meeting. Mm-hmm. For me, that's where the changes start. Now, you talked a little bit about AA. Are you a happy member of the group?
I am, very much so. My first AA meeting, I don't remember much. I bawled through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very fortunate. I live about 4 blocks from the Alano Club.
Mm-hmm.
So any time of day, I can pretty much any time of day. I can hit a meeting. Or I can grab a phone, call somebody, and say, I need you to get me through this next hour and a half. I need help. And even now, there are days, and it's not the alcohol I'm after, but it's just some kind of comfort, somebody to just take me by the hand and reassure me that I'm going to be okay. And that's where those phone lists, they come in handy. You know, we hand them out and people look at it and go, yeah, whatever, and throw it in the glove box. Work it. Those people sign that there for a reason. They are willing to help. And I didn't ever believe that until I started calling a couple numbers and people are like, oh yeah, I was hoping you were going to call. I'm like, really? What the heck? Yeah, did me? You know? Yes, I go to a couple meetings a week. There's a 4 o'clock on Sunday at the Alano Club in Clarkston. Wonderful women's meeting.
Nice.
And it's not just the alcohol. It is, whether it's NA people, everybody is welcome. It's an open meeting. And it is fabulous. Nothing against the guys, but it's nice to have just a group of chicks to talk to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's a women's meeting up here in town on Monday nights that, as far as I know, they've only had one gentleman attend the meeting, and he just really needed a meeting. And they said, well, come on in, but sit quietly in the corner, which is only fair. Meetings and phone lists. Somebody once said that in a meeting, a new person was in there and they passed around a phone list with this, you know, it's on the back of a schedule for people who aren't familiar. And this fella handed him the phone list and said, the clothes washing machine is the worst enemy of this list. Don't just leave it folded up in your back pocket. Mm-hmm. And when I came in, I used that phone list too. I clung to it with all the desperation of a drowning man to a life preserver. And I was amazed that not necessarily the first or the third or the fifth person on the list, you know, I went to some large meetings in California, so that list could have 30 people on it. And it might be the 28th person that finally was able to pick up the phone at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and say, yeah, what's up? What can I do for you? You need to talk. You need to go to a meeting. You need a ride. What's the deal? What's the dealio? What can I do for you? And it's an amazing thing. But then once you're in too, you start developing a group of people you can trust that have been where you've been, or at least in the neighborhood. And Denise, you have people in your circle that help you all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of my lady friends as well. I mean, they're just so encouraging, and it's just been so helpful. It replaces all that bad stuff so well. I mean, I think that's part of my story as to what led me to some of my addictive bad choices and with the drugs and stuff was just simply needing to have friends and community, you know?
I agree.
I mean, it's just, yeah. I was going to ask, so what are some of the positive things that you really enjoy being in recovery?
Well, one is the ability to go out with my fiance and friends. And I'm the DD and I'm good with that.
Designated decoy?
Something like that, yeah.
Kidding.
Yeah. I'm fortunate now that I can go out with them. Mm-hmm. But I've told my fiance, I said, every time you're out in a crowd and people are drinking, there is a certain point at which the mood in the room switches. And it's a shift that's just like a light switch. It goes from everybody's having fun, just people are starting to go over the top and get drunk. And I told him, I said, that is the point when I leave. Mm-hmm. And if you want to stay, that's your business. I'll come back and get you, mm-hmm. whatever you want to do. But that's when I have to leave. And that's actually one of the real benefits for me, because I'm able to go to concerts. Mm-hmm. I'm able to walk through a casino and watch everybody there going. And I'm like, yeah, no. Mm-hmm. Didn't even try it. Mm-hmm. Not interested. Mm-hmm. And I thought about it for a minute. I thought, yeah, that might be kind of, no, better not. Why push it? Mm-hmm. You know, the ability to have people know my story, and they may only know that I'm sober, but people will reach out to me knowing that I'm sober, whether they want to know when the next meeting is and how to contact people, whether it's just they have an event and they want it. You know, I can put events together now and let somebody else deal with the alcohol. I have family that I have difficulty with. I have one family member that is every night from 4:30 till bedtime drinking alcohol. And I told them, I can come out during the day. Can't come out in the evening. Can't do it. It's just not, my sobriety is not worth sitting there and watching them get loaded. They really had a problem with that at first. What do you mean? No, I love you, but no, mm-hmm. I gotta love me. And that was hard because do two different things that were happened to me when I was young. I had no self-worth. I had no self-confidence. And the alcohol served as a mask, kind of like that duck and the eagle thing. You know, it just was really one of those things that I felt made me feel better. The speaker that I referred to is really good with anagrams. And my daughter has listened to those CDs for years. And one of them is the word sober. Son of a bitch, everything's real. My daughter is now 31 years old and still quotes that. Mm-hmm. She knows. She's dealing with some things on her own with a family member of hers on the other side. She knows. She gets it. And that's what I'm grateful for. I'm grateful to be able to spend time with my daughter. Mm-hmm. My grandkids, you know, they can call me anytime. Leave me a voicemail if I'm at work and I ring you back. But having a loving family that likes to have me around, isn't embarrassed or appalled at my behavior, that's the good stuff. And it doesn't happen overnight. But if you stick with it, it does happen. And that's good.
Yeah, talk about not happening overnight. In my sobriety journey, because sobriety for me is not a destination. It's a journey. I don't drink today, but that's not being sober. At least not in my mind.
Yeah.
You know, sobriety is a state where clear thinking persists and doing things that are bad for me and the world around me don't come into the picture. Right. It's not what I'm about. Every day in AA, we strive to, on a daily basis, improve our conscious contact with higher power of our own conception. I call mine a god of my non-understanding because I find that keeps me humble. I don't exactly understand it, but I have a relationship with this power in the universe that's greater than me, which I choose to call God because I'm lazy. It's only three letters. So simple. And it's through trying to improve that relationship that I have a good effect on people around me. You know, just listening to those speaker tapes, CDs you're talking about, obviously had a positive influence on your daughter. It made her recognize. I grew up in a family that was, you know, both my parents were active alcoholics most of my life. And no doubt in my mind that I learned some of my drinking habits from them. But that's not always the case. Denise, you're in your journey through addiction and recovery, you didn't have super bad influences all around you.
I didn't. And I didn't start using any kind of like substances until I was like 27. So, and I didn't grow up in a house where there was alcohol or drugs. And so completely different thing. I mean, it winded up just being a coping thing that I came across because of being around people that did that. And I was around people who, you know, did some things when I was in high school and middle school, but I was a mom at 15. And I remember my mom always saying, You know, if you have someone in your car that has some stuff on them or something and you get in trouble, you could lose your daughter. And that was all that had to be said for me. That was it. That was one conversation. I don't even know if she like meant it to be so impactful, but it was. And so, I don't know. I always thought all the guys that were smoking weed and being stupid, I was like, you guys are so boring. I'm going to go out. I'm going to go dancing with my girlfriends. I'll see y'all later. Bye-bye. And that was that, you know. But then I came to a new town and met new people. And, got involved in different kinds of things. Just super recreational at first. And then got prescribed my first hydros. And then we were off. You know, which is actually interesting because I had those when I had a couple of my kiddos, my first kids that are adults now, I had those when I was younger and it, you know, I wasn't going out and like trying to buy them off the street or anything. So
right.
I don't know. I probably enjoyed them while I had it, but I didn't think anything of it.
Right.
You know,
right.
So.
Right. Well, there has to be a mindset around it as well.
Did I answer your original question? I think I did.
Sure.
About growing up in
it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it wasn't really all around me or anything. It may be in some genetic kind of stuff.
Mm.
I'd say that's probably
fair.
Right,
because you did,
yeah.
I think you have mentioned to me that on your father's side, there was some addiction.
So, yeah. So, my grandparents, I believe, on my dad's side, I believe, were alcoholics. I wasn't really ever around them. And then my father came back from Vietnam and had some drug use time. Before getting his self together is what I heard.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. So, and, you know, I do believe that there's probably a genetic link to addiction or at least a propensity to it. I met a fellow, side story, I met a fellow that I worked with whose father was like quite literally, you know, genius level. This man invented radar. And that was this gentleman's father. And he was an alcoholic, a maintenance drinker, alcoholic, and he died an alcoholic death.
The dad or the son?
The dad.
The dad, okay.
And the son, watching this, never touched a drop of alcohol his entire life. But in retrospect, looking back to the conversations that I had with him, he had every other ism of alcoholism.
Right.
He just had never taken a drink. Mm-hmm. And just in talking to a lot of other alcoholics that I've known over a couple of decades of sobriety, that there's always one in the woodpile somewhere in the family. Grandpa didn't drink much, or grandpa drank a little bit, or grandma was a drunk, or Pappy had a still, and it always seems like there's a little something in the background. Because for me, you know, I drank socially. I always wanted more, but I mean, I wasn't a total jerk drunk till near the end of my drinking career. But I had all those isms still. That was the more kid, like I said earlier. So whether or not my drinking was aberrant early on, it still was an indicator that I really wanted something because life wasn't satisfactory. Life on life's terms, just not good enough.
Yes, it always sounded like there was a bit going on at home.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And there always was.
Yeah.
But I had other healthier ways to get around it, like running away to my friend's home and hanging out with a normal, healthy, non-alcoholic family. You know, I saw them have friends over for cocktails and a couple of drinks and some laughs, and they talk about books they read or what was going on at work. And by 8:30, it was all over and people went home. I'm like, what's going on here? When do the polka records come out? You know, when do things start getting really fun?
Mm-hmm.
And I gravitated when I was little. I gravitated towards my friends that had families like that. Because it was just so much more comforting than being in the home I was in, where people are screaming at each other all the time.
I understand. And I know for me, one of the benefits of the program is I have found communication.
Mm-hmm.
My dad used to always say, our family just doesn't communicate. Well, no, he was the normie in the family. Mm-hmm. So he spotted it. The rest of us, not so much. nobody ever said, grandpa and grandma on this side of the family were alcoholics. Your grandpa on the other side, his brother had a still and they brought moonshine to town. I didn't ever know that being at home in the evening with my parents, watching them drink every night, I didn't know that that was a bad thing. I didn't know that dad could have a couple and he would be fine. Mom had several and she'd go pass out. Nobody explained it to me. I didn't get it. Now here I sit with my daughter and my grandchildren. The granddaughters are old enough. They understand that great-grandma has an alcohol problem. Grandma has an alcohol problem, but she's not doing it anymore. She's in recovery. If she wanted to go back out, she could, but she knows what it'd be like. So she loves life and her family more than to go out for that next drink. Those girls know. My grandson will know because I think he's going to be our wild child. And, and you know, just they get it because we're talking about it. Mm-hmm. If somebody would have told me, I still wouldn't have really known what it was, but I maybe would have recognized it when I was on the other side. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we don't recognize it even staring in the mirror until it smacks us in the forehead.
Right.
And, you know, it has to do it several times before we get the clue. Just being able to communicate with people, being able to share this with you guys today. Mm-hmm. I've known Johnny literally forever, practically. Yeah. And he has seen me at both. He's seen my personality before and after. And it's nice that people like me today.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think, oh, we can't invite Steve over because she's going to drink us all under the table. Well, this day and age, the only way I'm going to drink somebody is under the table is if we're drinking coffee.
I'm a challenge fan
of coffee, too. I don't know that I can have more than one white chocolate mocha, but...
Oh, it's on my Facebook page. Ooh, you know, I'll drink like you under the table as long as it's coffee.
I like the coffee.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, and not everyone is fortunate enough to have two sets of reference. And I think it's important that everyone does have that conversation. God bless Nancy Reagan, but just say no is not enough. Mm-mm. It is not enough. I like the idea of, you know, having the bad example somewhere to share with children and say, mm-hmm. yeah, this guy started out drinking just like you want to. And through a twist of fate and genetics, this is what his life is like now. If you want to pursue that, that's up to you. But take a good look. Take a really good look and realize that this is not something I'm making up. This is a choice that people can make, that you can make if you want to go there. And yeah, sometimes it means showing people some ugly stuff. But it's real. It's real.
Well, and I've heard people talk about country music. You lose your house, your dog, your wife, your truck, you know, and you play it backwards and you get all those things back. Mm-hmm. Well, recovery is that backwards. You work it. You're worth it. You do the do. And then you start getting these things back in your life.
Yeah.
Things that you didn't realize how much you counted on them and how much you cherished them because you were looking through alcohol glasses.
Yeah. It seemed like the drink or the drug was more important. And it was like, well, there goes that. That sucks. But, you know, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know what to do about that because I'm on this journey of wrecking myself. And And I didn't know until I was in, you know, the Latah County Jail that I was an addict. I got Alpha NA book and started reading in there. Looky there. There's Denise. She's right there on all those pages. I could so relate. How did I not see this before? Boy, oh boy, oh boy. Denial, 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 yeah. denial, denial. I was good.
I mean, I know that I drank alcoholically, but I couldn't put the label on myself as an alcoholic. Well, and also because in my younger days, alcoholics, the word alcoholic was synonymous with drunk. Mm-hmm. He's a drunk, she's a drunk, exactly. They're a drunk.
Yeah, those people
is
what I heard.
Yeah, they're alcoholics, which meant they were drunks. Well, no. One of the reasons I was so grateful to find my way into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they explained to me what an alcoholic really is. And yeah, primarily it has to do with the effect alcohol has on my brain and the way I behave when I drink it. But it also explains to me what alcoholism is and what it is in my brain that allows me to drink to oblivion and think that's okay. Yeah, you talk about denial, the place that is not a river in Egypt. Mm-hmm. It's a place that, for me, I had to go at some point full on, full in, because the doctor said, you have alcoholic hepatitis, and this is the first step in the journey to cirrhosis, and
yeah,
you're
fun.
32 years old. So,
yeah, ouch.
I cut back a little, which means I went back to, you know, a pint and a half a day rather than a quart or as much as I could get, whatever that was. Yeah, so it's a disease, and I got to learn that. And I got to learn that I wasn't defective, I was sick. And I found an answer for myself there. Mm-hmm. So I was happy with that. And it's allowed me to treat myself like I would treat any other sick person. I mean, I wouldn't treat a person with cancer with disdain or comment on, well, it was probably, you know, some moral shortfall of theirs that caused them to be ill. No, it's a disease. Not everybody is fortunate enough to catch it. And it is a disease that kills regularly. I forget what the statistic is, but there's probably somebody dying of alcoholism right now somewhere. Probably many people dying of alcoholism right now somewhere. Probably somebody in this county. Who knows in this town?
For sure.
For some reason, every time I hear a siren, I'm wondering, Who had a stroke or a heart attack because of their drinking? Who just fell down the stairs and bloodied their face because they were drinking? Is just omnipresent with me.
One another thing about the communication is people are starting to put in the obituaries. So-and-so was a friend of Bill W.
Right.
We see that now. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have seen that before.
Right.
And it's nice to know that the families appreciate that relationship that that person who passed away had with Bill W. and the friends of Bill W.
Right.
Yeah.
They appreciate that. They acknowledge that.
Right.
That's huge for me anyway.
Yeah. And for those who aren't aware, Bill W. or Bill Wilson was one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a co-writer of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, where the groups actually stole their name from, along with him and a fellow named Dr. Bob, were the first two AAs back in Akron, Ohio in the early 30s. So, you know what? At the beginning, with Dr. Bob and Bill W., I think that's a good place to wind it up here today.
Yeah.
We worked our way all the way back to the beginning. Isn't that amazing?
It's funny how that happens.
We all get there. Well, Jane, I want to thank you so much for coming up from the valley to do the show with us and share your experience, strength, and hope with everyone.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic to see you up here.
Well, thank you, Johnny, and
thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Fantastic. And I hope we didn't freak you out too bad.
A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit of nerves, come on. Yeah, we get that. And Denise, thank you.
Thank you, Johnny.
For showing up and suiting up and showing up and being here today.
My pleasure.
I will close with the usual statement, which is, if you think you have a problem with drugs or mental health issues, you do.
I'm blind. Perhaps there's a thing or two I think of lying in bed I shouldn't have said. See, it's all clear. You were meant to be here from the beginning. Maybe I might have changed, not been so cruel, not being such a fool. Whatever was done is done. I just can't recall. It doesn't matter at all. You see, it's all.